your model, the ghost number current, gave it a charge minus 1/2. Then there was another ground state obtained from that by acting with C0. So after C0 goes this way, the zero model, the C ghost, and B0 sends you back. This had zero mod minus 1/2, and this has zero mod 1/2. Actually, it's conventional, for reasons that will become clear momentarily, to expand the ghost number current in modes with an extra minus 3/2 here. So that if you're discussing the zero mode, the eigenvalue of the zero mode, which is usually called ghost number, then this guy would have ghost number 1. This guy would have ghost number 2. And then there would be a rather important state, which is in minus 1 over G. Right, more to the left. Echoes number 0. Okay. And you can keep building other states, of course. For example, here you could find P minus 1, C 0, G, and so on. Now, and here you find that the dual called 0 tilde, which is C minus 1, C 0, G. Now, I'm just focusing on the holomorphic part, but of course, there are also the anthropomorphic components of the ghosts. So really, there are four ground states. There is G, C 0, G, C 0, bar, G, C0, C0 bar, G, which have, okay. Now, let me try to explain a little bit better what's the meaning of this ground state G. So G has a property that is killed by the action of the ghosts with positive level, and the action of the big ghosts with non-negative levels. Now let's go back for a moment to the point before gauge fixing. Okay, so you ultimately want to study the behavior of a string that comes from infinity on a worksheet with the shape of a cylinder. And then perhaps it's going to interact with other strings, have some scattering process. So whenever you have a problem with some boundary condition, with some boundary at infinity, you need to pick some boundary conditions to define your problem properly. You need to pick a boundary condition on your fields and a boundary condition on your gauge symmetries. For example, a possible boundary condition would be to say that as you go towards the infinite past, the metric will be flat or conformally flat. And you would only consider these homomorphisms which don't change the geometry very badly at infinity. Now, the diffeomorphisms can be expanded as anything in modes. So essentially, you would only consider diffeomorphisms which decay at infinity exponentially. You would not worry about diffeomorphisms that have positive n. So in a similar way, so when you gauge fix, you want your state. So your state must represent the fact that you only want to consider modes of the sea ghosts which don't blow up in the far past. And this is essentially this condition. And you can interpret the condition of the big ghost in a similar fashion. About, you know, because as you remember, the big ghosts are related to the capital B that encodes your gauge fixing. And clearly, if you're assuming the metric is essentially flat far in the past, you don't need to gauge fix it. So your gauge fixing only affects modes of the metric which go to zero to the far past. Now, there is a particular mode that you could, a particular diffeomorphism, which is the zero mode, right? Translations and rotations. And perhaps it could be up to you if you, I mean, for that mode, there is a bit more freedom of choice. You could say that you want your boundary, your diffeomorphism, your gauge transformation to include rotations and translations of the past, near the past, or not. And roughly, this would be the choice between working with G or C0 of G. Okay. Now we're going to try to build states in the Q cohomology, which describes all possible excitations of the string that are coming in from the past. These states are going to look like some state for the matter fields, tensor with this ground state for the ghosts. So the matter field state is going to tell you how is the string oscillating, and the ground state of the ghost is setting up the correct boundary conditions for the gauge transformations in the past. And we're going to find a whole tower of string modes that leaving us number one. Now, you could have worked at the different boundary condition where translations were allowed as a symmetry, dilatations. So it were not allowed. I'm saying it the wrong way. Actually, this ground state corresponds to allowing for diffeomorphisms that rotate or translate this flat metric. I'm sorry. This one would correspond with posing stricter boundary conditions where you don't even allow those diffeomorphisms. And it's possible to work with that. So then you would study string states states in the cohomology that look like this. Okay. And you could do everything with these guys. It'll be fine. The main difference is that because you have fewer diffeomorphisms, your moduli space of gauge fixed metrics is bigger. So you work with a slightly bigger moduli space of complex structures. And you have more B's that come from the integral over this moduli space, and you have more C's from using the states. But ultimately, I believe you'll get the same result. I only sketched it on my own, but I think that's correct. For some reason, so we'll find, essentially, you can find another. All the strings K states have a representation in here, and they have another representation in here. It goes number two. And sometimes this is seen as a bit of a puzzle, but not much of a puzzle, just that the formalisms allow you to make different choices of boundary conditions. These choices are ultimately equivalent. But you have the tools that allow you to work with either choice.
How do I know that the correct translate is G when I allow translation of introduction?
Well, so see here I set, I ensure that all the C's that correspond to modes that are exponentially growing in the past kill this state, which means I'm not doing the diffeomorphisms that are exponentially growing in the past. But C0 does not kill this, which means I'm not trying to kill diffeomorphisms which are constant in the past. Yes?
So I probably don't see clearly the correspondence between the gauge fixing conditions and the ghost states that we kind of construct from this from this ground state and the businesses.
Well, so I'm not providing a general interpretation for all the possible states we can build out of the ghosts. Okay. I'm just trying to explain which sort of states do we need to answer a physical question, which is that this string mode coming in from the past with some reasonable boundary conditions. Other states, there is cohomology in some other ghost, in other ghost numbers too, not much, a little bit. Which allows you to answer different questions. There are other physical questions you could ask besides scattering of strings. For example, you could ask how a symmetry acts on a string state. Those sort of questions are encoded in different Q homology in different ghost numbers. But if the question you're asking are just what happens when I send in a string with a specific configuration, then these are the states, the sort of states which are involved in answering that question. Now, so what we need to find out now is which of the states are Q closed? Which of the states are BRST, are killed by the BRST charge? Now, writing down the BRST charge itself is a little bit, the full BRST charge is a little bit cumbersome, but it's much easier to use a specific property of the BRST charge, which is the anti-commutator between the BRST charge and the ghosts, the B ghosts. See, states of this form are killed by the positive, the non-negative modes of B, right? So suppose I have a state of this form, which is also killed by Q. Then I can write the following. I can ask, what happens if I do QBN acting on this state? So B kills it. For n big greater than equals to zero. Q kills it, which means that in particular it must be killed by Ln. Now L receives contributions from the matter fields and from the ghosts, but this guy has Lz has okay, but this guy is actually killed by all the positive modes and has eigenvalue minus one for L0. So this becomes for positive n, Ln for the matter fields and for the n equal to zero, L0 for the matter fields minus one. So if you look for Q cohomology, we better look at it among the states which are killed by positive modes of L and having a value 1 for L0. If you remember, these are the conditions which we imposed last week. So among states of this form, now I have not shown you that this is not just necessary, it's also sufficient. is not so difficult, but it requires writing down Q. And Q has pieces that look like C sum over Cn L matter fields minus N plus some C, Cb, and C stuff. And writing down the explicit expression, it's possible to show that these cases satisfy these properties are indeed in the Q cohomology. And it's possible with a bit more work to prove that this, to prove an August theorem, which tells you that indeed that these are the cohomology in Gauss number one. And it's a nice space which has a nice positive definite inner product. So there are no null states left. Okay, so this provides the justification for the formula we started with last week. We also said last week that right the null states were states of the form L of something. And now I wish I could just say that states of the so suppose that I have a state which is of the form L minus N M prime tensor G. I would like to show that this is null, that this is Q of something. So it will decouple from everything you do. Well, you can kind of write it as Q of B minus N, M tensor G. It's almost okay, except that when you commute Q across, because when you commute Q across B minus N, you get L minus N. But then Q might not quite kill this. So you typically need to add a few more things. But the process stops at some point. So again, it's a bit tedious, but it's a theorem that all null states are Q. All null physical states are Q exact. We know that these guys are null because they have zero inner product with the guys, with the physical states. But I'm not going to prove these statements. But at least this is how these statements can be proven. Okay, so combining last week analysis with this description of the Gauss, we can we have a reasonable understanding of how the spectrum of open of the free string theory comes about, and how you so we so now we know how to describe the tachyon, the graviton, and all the other string states. Now, the next step is to learn how to put them inside a scattering amplitude. So that the next problem that we face is given a, to make sense of a picture like this. Where I'm inserting specific states. So, I mean, the problem is definitely well defined. I'm given a two-dimensional space. I have a bunch of free bosons on it and a bunch of free ghosts. I have boundaries, but I've set some states at those boundaries at infinity. So this is a well-defined quantum field theory problem, free quantum field theory problem. So it looks bad, but it's not It cannot be too hard. Just free field theory, free two-dimensional quantum field theory. But still, it's useful to manipulate it in a way that makes it a little bit more manageable. It's particularly cumbersome to work with these semi-infinite tubes coming out of my space. So the first trick to use now is to use a transformation that flattens these semi-infinite tubes. So we're going to use something called the state operator map that allows us to replace a semi-infinite tube with a state with a flat patch with an operator. So we're going to do a simple manipulation in free field theory, which relates a picture like this to a picture like this. So this funny surface is going to become something that's topologically the same, which is a sphere with 4 points removed. And then we're going to stick some operators at those points, which mimic the presence of the states here. Then after we do that, we have a simple correlation function on the sphere. The sphere is conformally equivalent to the plane. So we have a simple correlation function of free field theory on the plane, and that we definitely need know how to deal with. So the state operator map is actually a general property of quantum field theories, not just in two dimensions, of a conformal field theories, not just in two dimensions. So I would guess that those of you that have gone to the conformal field theory course, we probably have encountered it. But I'm gonna, as usual, not assume that. Let's see, what is the best way to describe this? So, as you observed, a theory like a free scalar is invariant under complex coordinate transformations. Okay, it's conformal, which are the conformal transformations in two dimensions. So they're transformations that map a flat metric to a metric that is flat up to a wild factor. There are all sorts of coordinate transformations that you can use. But typically this can be understood locally or globally. So locally, this means that if you can compute a correlation, you can define this quantum field theory in a complicated complex manifold just by defining it in flat patches and gluing the patches together by conformal transformations. And then another manifestation is that, so this means that for a given manifold, you can use different coordinates, local coordinates, when you do your calculations, and the result will be the same. Now, there are also holomorphic maps between manifolds. So you could do a conformal transform, a coordinate change that maps. Okay, let me just give the main example of a nice coordinate transformation, which changes the manifold just a little bit. So here S is my standard coordinate on this cylinder. So this is a map from the cylinder into something. I would like to understand what that something is. Well, into the associate to each point on the cylinder a complex number. So let's take the complex, let's take our cylinder with the usual flat coordinate system on it. So with these two coordinates, sigma and tau, where tau runs along the cylinder and sigma runs around. I'm going to use this map. And this maps the cylinder to a plane from a transverse coordinate, z. The lines of constant tau become circles centered around the origin. The lines of constant sigma become radial lines. So this is just the, you know, these are just the usual polar coordinates for the plane. Now, as you see, this map maps the cylinder to almost all the complex plane, except for the origin. There's no point on the cylinder which is mapped to the origin. So this is a conformal transformation. So you would expect that it will relate somehow correlation functions on the cylinder to correlation functions on the plane. But the main question is, for what do I need to do at the origin for this to be an equality? So a correlation function on the left depends on the operators I'm inserting and on the states I'm putting in the past and in the future. Where, and I need to figure out where is this choice made here. Now, okay. So let's just run through some examples. Well, actually, let's think a bit before I'm doing some examples. So I mentioned, so in the theory of free scalar, we have this sort of expansion. So this relates an operator. To the expansion in terms of modes. When I do a conformal transformation from the plane to the cylinder, I also expect to have some simple transformation in the operators inserted on the cylinder and the operator inserted on the plane. Now, if you look at a ground state, on the free scalar, the one that is killed by all the ANs, get or equal to zero, this state has the property that, so this property essentially telling me that when I act on the vacuum with the SX, nothing blows up. So if I looked, if I'm computing expectation values of the SX on the cylinder, the expectation value will not blow up as I go towards the past, will not go exponentially as I go towards the past. So if I want this to be an equality, I expect something like this to happen here too, that when I bring my other operators, my dx, ds, dzx, the origin, nothing will blow up. Now, if I put anything here, any operator here, it will make dx blow up when I go to it. So the obvious expectation is that if I put the vacuum here, that indeed corresponds to putting nothing here. Similarly, when I bring operators to infinity, I don't expect them to blow up. And for that reason, I expect to be having a vacuum here as well. So this expectation is actually borne out by the facts, meaning you might remember we computed this correlation function on the cylinder. I mean, again, as usual, I'm ignoring for a moment the fact that these are delta function normalizables. I'll go back to that. Then you can, if you're worried about it, you can just divide by the inner product within the vacuum itself. So this was e to the s plus s prime over e to the s minus e to the s prime squared. Now applying this relation, this agrees perfectly well with the statement that the correlation function of dzx, dz prime x on the plane is 1 over d minus z prime squared. This is the second derivative of the Green function. See, if you compute correlation functions of x just with the path integral, you get something a little bit unpleasant, like log of z minus z prime squared. Then you take derivatives, you get this more pleasant expression here. Okay, so you can do this with more insertions of dx, but you can guess that you're going to get something that's still consistent, because after all, things are computed with weak contractions, both in this setup and in this setup. So once the two-point function work out, everything else is going to work out. So this gave us the first entry of this state operator map, the state 0 is in correspondence with the operator 1. Now, how do we populate this dictionary? Suppose I wanted to find, for example, the operator, the manipulation of the plane of the origin, which correspond to inserting a minus one acting on the vacuum. Well, we know what a minus one is. It's inside here. So this is just the limit as s goes to minus infinity of the sx e to the s acting on the vacuum, right? When I act dx on the vacuum, all the positive and zero modes drop out. The most, the surviving term, the term that decays the slowest as I go to the past is a minus one. I multiply by d to the s to make it well normalized, send s to minus infinity. I get a minus one of the vacuum. Now, which means that if I want to, this was a minus one, of course, which is accompanied by e to the s. So I'll put e to the minus s to cancel it. Now notice that this essentially tells you that if you want to, this is telling you that if I want to convert this into a minus one of the vacuum, I take an insertion of dsx, e to the minus s, and I send it to the past. So here, what I'm doing, I'm just sending to the origin this ex. So I have this ex of z, and I'm sending z to zero. This is a perfectly fine manipulation. There was nothing at the origin, so I can surely bring an operator to the origin. And so I discovered the second entry of my state operator map. If I want to compute a correlation function on the cylinder with a minus one of the vacuum inserted, I just need to put a dx at the origin. And it's not difficult to keep going. For example, if you want to put a minus two, that's the same as putting the second derivative of x. If you want to put a minus one squared, well, you're going to put the zx, normal order, and so on and so forth. But all of this gives me the whole Fock space built out of the vacuum. So if my objective was to study a string that is not moving, I'd be done, but that's not my objective. I want to put momentum. So there is a crucial entry missing from this dictionary, which is what happens to the state, to a state with momentum. And it's a bit confusing, right? Because I seem to have already run out of states. Pretty much I've gotten everything I can make out of derivative of x. Well, so all that I've left with to, all that I'm left to work with is x itself. So I need to build out something with x, which might correspond to this Fock space. So if I want to follow this logic, and I need to ask myself, is there some operator I can place on the cylinder which brought to the far past converts the vacuum without momentum to vacuum with momentum? Or is there some operator which shifts the momentum? So I need to, an operator that shifts the momentum is an operator that does not commute with a zero. Now remember, a zero was the momentum mode, so the something does not commute with a zero is just x. So if you remember the words when I was expanding the free boson, I found these two elements, x and p, which we had like just like a standard free particle. And now I want to build an operator out of this that shifts p. P was the same as a zero. Well, e to the i, well, UX fits the job. If I acted P on this, if I commutate, okay, this is the same as e to the I UX of P plus U. No, remember P is just minus ID over the X. So it brings down a. So I need to build something which contains e to the I UX. Now X was the zero mod of phi of the scalar field, which means I need to look at e to the I U X of S. So I need to make sense of this. Now this looks very strange. Right, when you study quantum theory, usually you look at operators built out of, which are polynomials in the elementary fields. This is something more complicated. The reason we can do it is that in two dimensions, the scalar field is dimensionless. So it actually kind of makes sense to, this expression can make sense. Still, we need to regularize it somehow. So, suppose that you're studying some path integral. You have your action, and then you want to insert some operators, and this operator. So at the level, because this is exponentiated, at the level of the path integral, there is a very simple way to do this, which is just to add this to the action. Right? So just adding a source for X to the action, a delta function source. Now, if you want to regularize the delta function, what you could do is to study an action with a linear term for X integrated against some source, some smear source. So you can take some function which integrates to one, which has a little bump like this, and use it to regularize your delta function. Now, what's going to go wrong if I replace this with a delta function? Well, whenever I do Gaussian integrals with a linear term, I can deal with it by shifting the quadratic term, shifting my definition of X in the integral. So the quadratic term eats up the linear term. For example, if I have an integral like e to the minus 1/2 ax squared plus I bx, the value of that integral is e to the minus b squared over a. Concretely, for example, if I do this path integral without any insertions, I get something that looks like e to the b squared over 2 integral in ds prime, ds double prime, f of S is prime. F of S is double prime. Well, really, the Green function. So 1 over A is 1 over the propagator, is the green function, this is B squared. And this was supposed to be U, sorry. So if I try to replace this with delta functions, I'll end up with a propagator evaluated at S, S. This is going to diverge logarithmically. So I need to cancel the logarithmic divergence. So to do so, I just define my operator as inserting this in the path integral and also rescaling the whole path integral by adding this counter term by hand. Okay, so this is going to be the definition of my operator. Bit lengthy, but the regularized definition of my operator. I exponentiate this mirror version of x and rescale it by this amount. And then I take the limit for f going to the delta function. And this will be finite. Mm-hmm.
So that expression that you wrote on the top one, which is repeated there, what is that supposed to be?
Sorry, it is? This is supposed to be this. When I take for B this, and for A the action. So this is the definition of my operator. So looking at this definition, we can see some interesting properties. For example, we can ask what happens to this operator under coordinate transformations. So when I write this, I really mean this limit. So if I have some new coordinate as tilde of S, and I try to compute e to the I u x of S, the relation between e to the I u x of S and e to the I u x of S tilde of S. Now, the same way as it happened for the stress tensor or for other composite operators, the regulator, so this part of the expression, the regularized expression, it's fine, transforms well, but the regulator transforms in a bit of a funny way, because here I used explicitly local coordinate. So that means that this operator equals this operator times the limit of e to the u squared over 2 integral, double integral of f and the log of s tilde of s prime minus s tilde of s double prime squared over s prime minus s double prime squared. Okay. Now we take the limit. This is a finite limit. This also has a finite limit, but on zero. And it becomes ds tilde over ds to the p squared. To the u squared, sorry. So this operator has a very funny behavior. It behaves like an operator of fractional dimension, u squared. See, if this was just a standard scalar operator, you would have no Jacobian. If it was, you know, an operator with one derivative, one, it would transform with a one power of the Jacobian. If I was looking at ds, ds bar, I'll get absolute value squared of the Jacobian. But here I get the Jacobian to the power of u squared. So this is an operator of fractional dimension determined by u squared.
The e to the
I K, I U X. Oh, the same, but the same, much as in the case of the stencil, I'm trying to give definitions which work on the cylinder and work in a curved space and not just on the plane. Normal ordering is how you define it on the plane. If you define it somewhere else, you need a slightly different definition. This definition works everywhere. And it helps understanding the origin of this Jacobian. Now, on the cylinder, we could have just tried to define this using the expansion in modes. That would also have been perfectly fine. So let's see how it looks like. Let me see if it worked. Yes, it probably is. So let me take the scalar field on the cylinder, separate the zero mode, and deposit positive and negative frequency. Now, I want to define e to the u, I u x. So there's going to be e to the I u x. Plus 2 u p tau. Plus IUX. Plus IU. Okay. So now, to do things properly, so we could suppose now we try to use this definition, okay? So we would start with e to the iu integral of f of s prime, x of s prime, expand it in mode, okay? And regulate it like this, and send f to z, to the delta function. Now, when you expand the z modes, you have an exponential of something which has both positive and negative modes. So you'll be looking at an expression which might, you know, something like e to the something, we call it the coefficient alpha 1, a 1, plus say alpha minus 1, a minus 1. I mean, here, all modes except an and a minus n commute, so let me just focus on an and a minus n, a 1 and a minus 1. So what do you know about this expression? It's a nice exercise to show that this can be rewritten as e to the 1 half alpha 1 alpha minus 1. The alphas and the a's are not really very readable, right? Let me just... See, this is a normal ordered expression. So this is how you normal order exponentials. So so as you can guess, when you try to make sense of this, you're going to normal, you're gonna have to split x into positive and negative modes, normal order it. When you normal order it, you're going to get something quadratic in the coefficients. So something roughly quadratic in F, which is going to cancel against this. So it cancel up to something finite, as usual. So it turns out that the final expression See, that's why I try not to erase anything. Because they don't really erase. So just applying this definition verbatim and a bit of patience, you arrive to this definition on the cylinder, which is properly normal ordered. Okay. And now you can see that you can define the state of momentum alpha, which is e to the I alpha x on the state of momentum zero, as the limit of s goes to minus infinity of e to the minus alpha square over 2 s minus alpha square over 2 s bar e to the I alpha x s s bar acting on the vacuum. So now finally we can bring this through the state operator map. When we do the change of coordinates between S and Z, this exactly cancels this, and we are left with the desired relation. So the momentum state on the cylinder becomes the insertion of this vertex operator at the origin. And now we're really ready to go, because we can do the same things here. We can take these states replace them with operators using the state operator map. So this is basically what you're doing. You're taking this funny surface and using some local coordinates on the cylinder, which look like that. So you get each half cylinder is mapped to the neighborhood of a point on the plane, and you insert at this point the operator that corresponds to the state by this map. Okay, so now we're really ready. Tomorrow we can compute a scattering amplitude. Okay, any questions? I should be asking this more. Please stop me and ask questions. No questions?